Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so blue. I knew you'd love me.
This is Gorgeous Escapes.
Here I'm in Soho with travel writer Sarah Wheeler, who wrote the international bestseller Terra Incognita, Travels in Antarctica. They're magnetic north notes from the Arctic Circle. She has published two biographies of travellers, Cherry, A Life of Asprey Cherry Garrard, and The Life and Times of Dennis Finch Hatton. And today, we're talking about Oh My America, Second Acts in the New World. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Sarah.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
So, Sarah, you said that you're immensely relieved to be writing about women. Tell us about the travel world. Is it mostly men, then?
Oh, it really is, yes. It's dominated by men. It always has been. And I'm afraid to say not much has changed since the 30s, one of the golden ages of travel writing. And I spent a lot of time in the polar regions, as you've mentioned, both the Arctic and the Antarctic. And those are really male-dominated worlds in the field of exploration, particularly in the Antarctic, where, of course, there's no indigenous population. And I wrote a lot about Scott and Shackleton and all that lot. And it's just frozen beards all the way. And the current crop of explorers, as they like to call themselves, it's all very testosterone-driven. And publishing a book with a picture of you on the cover with a frozen beard and all the rest of it. And so I battled my way through all of that as a lone voice. And it was a tremendous relief, as you've indicated, to write about women. People like me.
Exactly. So how did Oh America happen?
Well, the idea for Oh My America came when I happened to be reading about Fanny Trollope, who was the mother of Anthony Trollope. Well, she did the most extraordinary thing when she was 50 years old. She went to America, sailed across the Atlantic with three of her children in tow in order to try and make money. She had a useless husband left at home. Now, this was 1827, where America wasn't even America, really. It only extended as far as Cincinnati, which is where she fetched up. And she struggled for 3 years there and then came back destitute. All her plans to make money had failed. She was literally almost destitute. One of her kids had no shoes. And she wrote this amazing book called Domestic Manners of the Americans, which became a huge bestseller on both sides of the Atlantic. You have to remember at that time, nobody really knew anything about America. It was just a sort of upstart colony that had rather annoyingly become independent. And also everybody in America were very keen to find out what other people thought of them, because they were a new country. So America came good for her in the end, and she made a fortune through the book. So I was interested in that, and I was also interested in how you can reinvent yourself at the age of 50 as a woman. It's difficult being 50 now, becoming invisible. That's what all my girlfriends say they feel when one hurtles towards middle age and then out the other end, is that one is invisible. And it's such a sort of youth-orientated society, particularly for women, that once you get sort of the post-fertile years, it's like a sort of downhill catwalk. And so I thought the idea of reinventing age 50, my 50th birthday was on the horizon when I started writing this book. I became very interested in that idea and also in the fact that the 19th century was the century where America was inventing itself. The 20th century was the American one, now we're in the post-American, and it was becoming itself. And I thought that those 50 years, sort of in the middle, as it were, 1827 to when the rails joined the country together, 1877, were a very interesting one in the making of a country, and those two seem to come together. What the book is, it's the story of six British women, who went to America during that period and reinvented themselves in middle age. And I don't really remember looking out for any of them. Looking back, it seems that they fell onto my desk.
Yeah, I was going to say, how the hell do you find these women?
I think that's what research is, you know. That's why so much of the research I've always done, I don't know what I'm looking for until I found it.
Yeah,
it's the opposite of being an academic. and I kind of followed the country west. So the sixth one in the book, it was Jane Austen's niece. So being a writer, she was also a writer, Catherine Habakkuk, her name was. So being a writer was also a theme that ran all the way through. I'm a writer, so middle-aged woman, British writer, rings a lot of bells, going to discover themselves and this new land. And the last one, as I say, Jane Austen's niece, she rode the rails when the train joined the country together. So got to California in the 1870s, and there was no frontier anymore. So that was very significant in the development of America, the loss of frontier. You know, the role of the frontier in American history has been much written about, and it's very interesting. So with my girls, really, I followed the frontier west. And when the train, the transatlantic train, you know, they started building it from the east coast to the west coast at the same time, met in the middle in Utah, joined them up, and then there was no frontier. Or rather, of course, there was no domestic frontier. The frontier was overseas. So it started the period of colonial expansion, the Philippines and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, after that, people would say, well, the frontier went up into space with the moon and so on. So it seemed to me a very interesting period of development and a country becoming itself. And, of course, being British myself, I think that two things. One, if you come from a very old country, you don't feel that territorial sensitivity. I mean, for example, I've written a lot about South America, and all those countries are very young, and they're almost going to war every 5 minutes, all of them, about half a mile of land that nobody really wants. It's just that it's so sensitive. If you come from an old country, you don't understand that. And also, I think if you come from an island, it's difficult to understand. So I find all that very interesting. So I went off in search of these six women, followed in their footsteps in America, a lot of biographical sketches and some topographical writing about the places they were. In the case of some of them, like, for example, Isabella Bird, who was in the Rocky Mountains, the great thing about writing about that is that landscape hasn't really changed very much at all. It's not developed, so I see what she saw. Likewise, in Northern California, when Catherine Hubbard went travelling, the Cascades, the bottom end of the Cascades and the Maricama, I can see what they saw, and of course in other areas it's completely unrecognisable, New York, for example. But the second one of my girls, Fanny Kemble, she was an actress. And
she was the one I related to most.
She's a tremendously glamorous actress, a leading lady of the day and a big celebrity, although being a celebrity was more dignified then than it is now. And her father had an acting troupe, as was the way then. And when business got tough in England because of the Reform Acts and so on, he went on one of the first theatre tours of America, which was the East Coast. And she toured as Juliet and was an absolute sensation. And her name, as I say, was Fanny Kemble. And all the girls started wearing their hair in what they call Kemble curls. And in the end, she married one of her millions of admirers. And the poor father had to go home with his troupe with his tail between his legs. And she moved to Philadelphia. But the husband was a very wealthy man, but his wealth was based on slaves. And they went to live, she had two small children, and they went to live on the slave plantations in Georgia, the Georgia Sea Islands. It was rice and cotton. And it wasn't Tara. It was horrendous, absolutely horrendous. And she naturally, as a humanitarian, as a woman, as a kind person, tried to speak up for the slaves. But her husband's view, like that of all the culture, white culture at the time, was basically, they're not humans. How dare you speak up for them? They'll be, you know. And so it was horrendous, absolutely horrendous for her. And anyway, to cut a long story short, she ended up getting divorced, and naturally, as was the way then, he got everything, including custody of the girls. And she kept her mouth shut because she knew that by speaking out too much about slavery, she would lose what limited contact she had with her daughters. So fast forward a few decades when she was in her 50s and the Civil War is looming. She's living back in the UK by this time. And she was desperately on the Yankee side simply because the Yankees were going to abolish slavery. And so she felt this was her chance to influence public opinion. And it was tremendously important, obviously, to the Americans, both sides, with whom the British government sided. And it could have gone two ways. I mean, you've got all the Lancashire cotton mills. You know, they didn't want to hamper production, so they were pro-Confederacy.
True.
Anyway, so Fanny Kemble wrote this book called A Journal of a Residence on a Georgia Plantation. And it's one of the most true and heartfelt depictions of slavery that I've ever read. And it basically
changed. Can you tell us how grim it was?
Oh, it was grim beyond belief. I mean, women would start having children when they were about 15, half the time sired by the over-managers, the managers of the plantation, the white ones, and they'd basically go on having them until they died. And there was no hospitals. They'd be left in fetid shacks. They had to go out to work in the cotton plantations, even when they were pregnant. And if they fell down or fainted on the job, their husbands, also slaves, would be called to flog them. They'd make the husbands flog the wives. The children had every disease known, from vitamin deficiencies to all kinds of other things. So, and a lot of them died. So just the most horrendous conditions. And slave labour, literally, that phrase meant, you know, was sort of where it came from. They'd be punished for having the children of the plantation managers, even though they'd been raped on the job. And there was all sorts of bone deformities caused by vitamin deficiency. It was just horrendous. And Fanny Campbell describes all of that. And her book is, I think, widely thought to have altered the course of the Civil War, because it did marshal public opinion pro the Yankees. And when I went on in search of Fanny Campbell to the plantations where she lived, there's a few buildings, brick chimneys and so on left there. And there's a sign put up by the Georgia Historical Society saying this is where Fanny Campbell's house was, and Southern historians still say that she lost in the war.
Radio Gorgeous, online, on your phone, on a podcast, or on your tablet. Listen anywhere, anytime.
So that was quite something to achieve when you're 50 and you've been spurned by, you know, rejected effectively by conventional society. So
she could have a voice because of that. She had nothing to lose. So
yes, I think that's true. That's partly why she hadn't spoken up earlier when her children were small. But by that stage, you're right, the children were adults, so she had unrestricted access.
We love you, Fanny.
Yeah, we do.
And then can we just talk about the first Fanny again?
Because Fanny Trollope.
Yeah, her book. The
Domestic Manners of the Americans.
Can you tell us, because she said some, to me she was the most outrageous character in the book. Can you just tell us some funny things that she observed about the Americans?
Well, she thought that they had appalling manners, and she couldn't stand the fact that on the steamer going up the Mississippi, the men picked their teeth with knives at the table. And that the spitting, she couldn't stand spitting, which was widespread. And she said they would eat foot-long slices of watermelon when walking down the street and spit the seeds out. And that what she really hated was that everybody treated everyone else like an equal. And she was absolutely amazed when she first landed in America. It was in New Orleans. And she went into a milliner's shop. And the shop girl treated her like an equal, as one we would now. But, of course, that wasn't what she had in mind. Shop girls. She was brought up in Georgian London, very hierarchical, very stratified. And of course, that was what America was born not to be, the great melting pot and the great leveller. She couldn't stand it. And there's something very unattractive about her there in that judgment.
Yeah.
But still.
But that was the way she thought, you know, that was, you know.
She was brought up in Georgian London, And so, the only way she could conceive of society working was as a hierarchy, with everybody in their place forever and ever and ever.
So that probably really disturbed her when she was out there.
It really did, yeah. She really disliked it.
So she came back and wrote this kind of shocking book. They're classless, they have no manners.
Yes, and a lot of the things she said we'd think now were good, that they're classless and everyone's equal.
And I bet the English lapped it up.
They did. Well, the Americans didn't like it because she was rude, but at least they liked the fact that people were taking interest in them.
Yeah.
Rather than them being these country cousins who had nothing to offer. The old country was everything. And they were forging a culture of their own, which hadn't yet really got to the walking stage. Mm. So they liked the fact that people were taking interest.
Now I want to talk about your favourite character, who was the frontier woman. Yeah, she really was. Can you tell us about her?
Yeah. I realised, as I was getting towards the end of the book, that I had to have a homesteader. A homesteader is basically somebody who leaves Britain and goes to North America. There are many of them in Canada, as well as what's now the United States, and sets up in the middle of nowhere and has to be completely self-sufficient, and through back-breaking work and toiling the land, make good, so slowly, slowly by increments.
So they are the true pioneers.
They're the true pioneers, yeah, and that North American Society was made by them. And it was
And you said a lot of English people went, which I found really interesting, because I always thought it was Scottish, Irish, German, Dutch. You know, I never knew that it was so many English.
Oh, yeah, many, many, many. And so Rebecca Burland, her husband was a tenant farmer, and the price of corn fell disastrously, and they were in real trouble. She had 7 children. 2 of them were adults, and so they stayed behind. She took 5 with her. She was breastfeeding one when she travelled in steerage.
God. How long did it take?
6 weeks.
Oh.
And she had to cook at night, and they all shared accommodation. And I mean, how they did it, I just don't know. When I think about the things I complain around about in my house, when the dishwasher breaks and so on. and then they, like Fanny Trollope, they landed in New Orleans, and they went up the Mississippi, and they had organised to this place in western Illinois, and they got off the steamer. They went up, then they had to get a smaller steamer back down, and they got off the middle of the night in this place they'd been told to get off, where there was some land nearby. And so there's 5 kids, it's pitch black, there's nothing there, they just get off the boat and there's nothing there. And she said to her husband, "Is this America?" and burst into tears. And the next 2 years were almost unimaginable toil, almost unimaginable. And many would have died under the circumstances, and they both almost did die. Even he cut himself in a sort of what would be now a pretty ordinary farming accident with a scythe, but of course with no medication. And every week he would walk to the store, which was about a 2-hour walk, and those agricultural stores there, and because really cold in the winters in western Illinois, and there would always be the horses outside with steam rising up, and the men inside drinking a neat alcohol with tincture of cinnamon in it, and the women wrapping up all their parcels. And he'd just try and get a little bit more money so he'd able to buy 2 tin cooking pots, you know, which was a major step forward, and then some adult shoes, and then slowly, slowly, slowly. And after 2 years, she said, "I knew we were going to be all right."
You know, unbelievable.
No worry. I mean, then she knew she was going to be able to feed them all and so on. And then they prospered after that. She's the only one I didn't follow in her footsteps, because the area of Illinois they were in...
What's it now?
It's completely developed now, so there'd be no point in me going there, because there's nothing to see. And so when I was writing about her, I thought, you know, what can I do to try and get a line to her, because I can't go there. Her name, Burland, was quite not a common
name.
Yeah,
I've never heard of it.
So I thought, well, she had 5 children who stayed there. You'd think there'd be quite a few in that, if they stayed, some would have stayed in that small area of Pike County. So I had this idea, and by the end of the day, I was talking on Skype with her great-great-great-grandson.
How exciting!
And sent me a photograph of him standing next between their graves.
Oh.
So there's all these Burlands from those humble beginnings. And that's what the homesteaders were. They had made America.
And did he know of her? And
he did know a bit about her, yeah. He knew a bit about her.
And how did you... Did she write it down?
Well, no, this was the unusual thing about her. She's the only one who wasn't a writer.
Yes.
But there were these 2 children, as I said, who stayed behind. And one of them was a schoolmaster, a junior schoolmaster. And when she was in her 60s, she went home for the first time in all those years, because they could afford it then. So she went back. And he was there with his own family as a schoolmaster, and he said, because I don't think she was illiterate, but only would be functional literacy.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, "Mum, we've got to hear your story, you know, we've got to..." And so she told him all of this, everything I'm telling you, you know, so he privately published a book.
God, it's brilliant.
It is. I found it in the rare books room at the British Library. Only a few copies in existence. And it is an epic story. There are many epic stories of homesteaders, but I was glad to have her in there. And even in the worst of it, you know, she described leaning against the door jamb. I mean, when it was, you know, would have been minus 20 in the middle of the night in Illinois, and looking out over that, the frost and the mist and the sky and the stars, and appreciating the beauty of that landscape. She was able to do that even in the midst of what to us is unimaginable toil. I mean, you know, she had to feed 7 people with, you know, just sort of cornmeal, basically. It just beggars belief.
So that's corn just ground down, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what it is. Flour.
So it's like polenta
flour
or something.
Flour cakes.
Yeah, yeah. So they just ate that and drank water, I suppose, from a well.
Yeah. So it was a big red letter day when they were able to buy a cow, which was after about 2 years. That was obviously hugely significant because they could have milk and cheese and all the rest of it. Then you buy and,
yeah, but they had to make everything.
Of course, they had to make everything.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
So getting a couple of cows and they get a couple of pigs. That's how it went.
Was the land like virgin land when they arrived? How did they buy it?
The local government and indeed the federal government were just desperate to get people to come to work the land and build things up. So nobody was selling anything, and it was like staking a claim. It's like in the gold fields in a way. You just staked a claim, and after you'd been there a certain amount of time, it was yours. But of course, they had no farm machinery at all. So they often ploughed by the big first years they ploughed by hand.
Incredible.
And then they'd borrow somebody else's plough. And seeing how it was so wonderful seeing how they slowly inched forward.
So I'm just coming to the end of the interview now. What characteristic do all these women have in common, do you think? These 50-something women who've reinvented themselves.
Determination, independence of spirit, and the belief, often against all experience, that they could do anything they wanted. And I believe that, really, that you can do anything you want. But you have to want to a lot. You have to really want to.
Sarah Wheeler, thank you so much. So it's Oh My America, Second Acts in a New World, and it's published by Vintage Books. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
It was a pleasure.
RadioGorgeous.com.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so blue. I knew you'd love me as long as you wanted, and then someday you'd leave me for somebody new. Worry, why do I let myself worry? Wondering what in the crazy for thinking that my love could hold you. I'm crazy for trying and crazy for crying, and I'm crazy for loving you. Crazy for thinking that my love could hold you. I'm crazy for trying and crazy for crying, and I'm crazy for loving.